section on support vector machines, and we'll talk, if we have time today, a little bit about relevance vector machines. And since some of you missed last lecture due to some confusion about whether we were holding class, we briefly talked, we spent some time last class talking about generative models and how convergence and maximum likelihood does not guarantee optimal classification. And and then we define the concept of risk, expected risk. We talked about the difference between expected risk and empirical risk. And we talked about a very important result, which is that these are related by this bound, which is a function of the capacity of the learning machine. And that all of that forms the basis for what we're going to call learn today as a support vector machine. So let's talk first about large margin classification. So if we have these two data sets, class 1 and class 2, we can see that in this particular case, the data sets can be perfectly classified. We can achieve perfect classification, or what's called zero empirical risk, using a hyperplane. And there's actually many hyperplanes that will separate these data and produce 0% classification error. Which of these boundaries is optimum with respect to generalization? Well, if you think about that a little bit, you'll see that the C0 boundary is more than likely the one that's optimal with respect to generalization, because it's essentially the simplest of the two, and it sort of maximally divides the space between the two classes. The data points that define... So last time we talked about a class... We're going to try to build a learning machine today where the data points at the extreme of the boundary between the two classes form the function or the equation of the learning machine. So in this particular data set, these data points that define the boundary, these are what we're going to call support vectors, because they essentially support the decision surface or the equations for the decision surface between the two classes. Now, as we've seen throughout the semester, we can define a hyperplane actually by a dot product formulation, x dot w plus b. X represents the data, w represents the weights, and b represents an offset. And what's done with support vector machines is to build a machine whose output is binary. It's 1 if the data is in class 1 and 0 if the data is in class 2. So we're going to use a binary variable y to indicate whether the class assignment. And initially, we're going to talk about a support vector machine that essentially classifies two classes, a two-class problem. And later we'll talk about ways we can generalize that. So we can take this expression for the hyperplane, and we can actually write an equation, y sub I times x sub I wi plus b minus 1 is greater than or equal to 0. And that's a set of constraints that the data points must satisfy. And the data points that satisfy the equality are the data points that are called support vectors, because they're essentially the data points that lie at the boundary. So we're defining this is a very simple machine in that we're simply defining this hyperplane in terms of the data points x that satisfy these equations, and then your goal would be to find the w's and the b to satisfy that equation. Now the mathematical details of how you do this is actually a little bit complicated, and we're not going to go into that level of detail in this class. We do have the Java applet has a support vector machine mode in it, so you can actually play around with the classifier. But I want to discuss a little bit about how we go about solving these problems, because we use that solution then to generalize this approach to deal with a few other things. So the support vectors are actually found using a constrained optimization where we have essentially, we use an approach based on Lagrange multipliers, and we have the optimization equation is shown here. We have the norm of the weight vectors, we have then our constraint equations, and we have a sum of these alphas. And the alphas are essentially your, you can think of them as your Lagrange multipliers here. And the solution to this equation produces the alphas that then serve as the support vectors. Now, the actual, how you solve this equation gets a little bit more detailed, so we won't talk too much about it. But the thing I want you to know for this purpose is to just that this decision surface is essentially defined in terms of the data points that exist at the boundary of the two classes. And we find those data points by essentially optimizing this equation. Once you have those values of alpha, then the final classifier is essentially computed using the support vectors and the weight. So the final classifier is essentially of this form, where we have the support vectors, the corresponding class assignments of those support vectors, y's will be 1 or 0, and then these weights associated with the support vectors. So the classifier is still essentially fairly simple. It's just a linear machine, but the challenge is finding essentially the weights that that optimize this classifier. And like I said, there's some references on the title page if you want to read more about the details of that. It's pretty involved because you have to make use of a few theorems, since this is a nonlinear optimization problem. So you have to introduce quite a bit of theory to actually find the solutions. But in the end, the solutions are fairly computationally expensive. A lot of work has been done making the solutions for these equations to work on large data sets, because initially you could find these support vectors for small data sets, but you couldn't expand this to millions and millions of vectors. A lot of work's been done over the years on making doing this much faster, and most of the techniques essentially do some kind of iterative gradient search type process. And the details of that are in one of the references on the title page. So this formulation that I'm showing here was the classical formulation of support vectors, and it works fairly well if the data is linearly separable. Separable by a hyperplane. But that's not really what made support vector machines so powerful, because these problems, of course, are not of great interest to us, since not too many real-world problems fall in this class. So let's ask a couple questions. Let's first of all ask the question, if the decision surface is very complicated, like you tend to find in real problems, and you're essentially building the surface out of the vectors that describe the boundaries of the classes, what's going to happen as the complexity of your decision surface increases? Well, you're going to get more and more support vectors. So when we first started running this on speech data, for example, we were getting tens of thousands of support vectors, which is just way too many. And I'll talk throughout the lecture of different approaches to reduce that kind of complexity. But if the surface is very complicated, it's going to essentially have to allocate support vectors to describe all the complexity of that surface. So the complexity of the surface, or the number of support vectors, grows linearly with the complexity of the surface. And in real problems, the surfaces are complex, so that's a problem. A more important problem, or more serious problem, you could say, is that if you have mislabeled training data, support vector machines won't know that, and they'll actually model the mislabeled data and support and allocate support vectors to it. So if you have a data over here that really should be in class 2, but for some reason it was modeled in class 1, support vectors are going to try to model that data with support vectors. And after I show you, after the next slide, you'll really appreciate why that's a problem. But you can sort of imagine that the Gaussian modeling techniques we use tend to be robust to misclassified data because they're looking at averages. They're looking at aggregate properties of the data. And that's one of the advantages and one of the reasons why we apply these kinds of Gaussian models. But the techniques like support vectors and some of the neural network-based techniques, if you're not careful, they will model the mislabeled training data because from their point of view, that's important information about where the decision surface should be. So the first solution to this problem that was introduced is what are called the introduction of slack variables, or a soft margin classifier, as it's sometimes called. And these are fairly common today, but they were first introduced as a way to help improve the generalization of systems like neural networks and support vector machines that are prone to this kind of overfitting. And the slack variable approach is actually fairly straightforward. All we're going to do is allow an additional offset of the margin using these variables psi. This essentially allows you to move the boundary for each class away from what you might call the baseline hyperplane. And in the process then, as you increase the size, you can actually ignore more and more data. So introduction of these slack variables gives the system the ability to ignore data points near the boundary and effectively pushes the margin towards the centroid of the training data. This is a nice thing because it allows you to sort of you can turn a knob that lets you span either a Gaussian model solution where you're going to be based on the centroid or the mean of the class and a support vector solution where you're going to be at the extreme boundaries of the classes. And an introduction of this slack variable essentially just changes the optimization so that we now have a constrained optimization with this additional constraint that for each one of the classes, we have an additional variable that describes how much slack we're going to introduce. Now, fortunately, proof of this is fairly complex, but this kind of a problem can also be solved using Lagrange multipliers, and numerical techniques do exist to allow you to find both the support vectors and the optimal values of the slack variables numerically. And this kind of an approach is built into a number of optimization systems. So typically what you'll do ahead of time is you'll define a parameter that describes how much slack you want. And then you can then train the classifier under that condition. And instead of choosing support vectors near the boundary, if you set the slack large, it'll choose support vectors which are further away from the boundary. And then typically what you will do is you'll look at performance as a function of this slack variable, and you'll sort of experimentally optimize that for your data sets. But this approach, it's important because it allows you to control the number of support vectors that you're generating. And it keeps the number of support vectors reasonable. But why that's the case based on its optimization problem, again, it takes a little bit of analysis to show that. And there's a whole body of theory behind how you actually solve this kind of an optimization problem, which we won't go into in this course, or it's not in the textbook either. But if you work in this area, you'll get you'll get exposed to this. Now, the first problem that we had to deal with was the fact that the number of support vectors will become very large if we're not careful. The second problem, which is really much more important, and it's actually sometimes it's often confused as being an integral part of support vector formulation. But the second problem is essentially what happens when the data is not separable by a linear hyperplane? What happens when we require a nonlinear decision surface? And this was a problem that was actually thought about in the 70s, and support vectors were one of the first techniques to introduce a solution to this problem, but then eventually many, many different pattern recognition systems adopted this approach. So let me explain the approach a little bit, and then I'll talk a little bit more about what it's doing. So when you look at this data, you think about two things. You think first, it might be possible to train a classifier that has some kind of generalized shape. Then I could optimize the parameters of that function that describes this region. But it turns out those kinds of problems tend to lead to very difficult nonlinear optimization problems where you often won't find a good solution. What Vapnik and others propose is that a much better way to deal with this problem would be to rotate this data into a very high dimensional space where the data is separable by a linear decision surface. Now, let's think about that for a moment. You might think, well, my data cannot be separated linearly in some high-dimensional space. But if you think about it, even if you describe your features as 4-byte floating-point numbers, 32 bits per element of your feature, if you think about a space which has a dimensionality much larger than 32, every floating-point number is going to be a discrete point in that space, and you could very easily find a line between all of those points because the space has such a high dimension that it far exceeds the precision of your feature vectors, and your feature vectors essentially look like a discrete space because they ultimately, your feature vectors really only have a finite amount of precision associated with them. So that was one argument that was given, that no matter what features you're dealing with, you can always rotate them into a very, very high dimensional space where you can separate them. But then the question becomes, how do you actually find that space? You need some kind of nonlinear transformation. And it's hard for us to think about nonlinear transformations because it's going to distort the space in many different ways. But fortunately, there's a fairly well-defined body of mathematics based on what are called kernels. The idea is to define a kernel function which represents when we want to look at the distance between two vectors, we actually look at it through a computation that involves some function phi. So this function k of xi and xj, or this distance measurement between xi and xj, is now a function of xi and xj, but of this function phi. And this function phi then can become a function that does some kind of high dimensional transformation. Now, when this was introduced, kernels were quickly applied to just about every type of pattern recognition algorithm we have. So you'll find things like kernel principal components analysis now, where they combine the concept of a kernel with principal components analysis. You'll find kernels used extensively with neural networks. You may have heard things like radial basis functions. That's one example of a kernel. Initially, people were looking at polynomial kernels. These are one of the simpler kernels to use. And these amounted to taking the dot product, essentially, between xi and xj, the xi transpose times xj raised to the dth power. Soon, people looked at other popular kernel functions, and one of the very popular ones for neural networks was something called a Gaussian or a radial basis function, where you're essentially taking you're exponentiating the Euclidean distance between the two vectors. So it sort of looks like a Gaussian shape function. Another popular kernel was a sigmoid kernel, which involves the hyperbolic tangent of this xi transpose times xj. And all of these are probably the three most popular kernels. Today, actually, people are using data-dependent kernels. They actually take the training data and they derive kernels that are optimal for that training data set. And the data-driven kernels have been kind of a hot topic in the last few years in this area. When you do this, the optimization does not really change significantly. You're still going to have a very similar-looking optimization function. The only thing now is instead of having just the x's here, we're going to have the kernel function of xi and xj. So the optimization problem looks like this under the constraint that we have that our alpha, our constant, our weights are essentially bounded by this constant c. This is using the slack variable approach. But once you're done with all of this, the final classifier actually just has a very simple form where you're simply computing the kernel between x, a test vector x, and your support vectors xi. You're weighting it by the class assignments, weighting it by the alphas, and then offsetting it by b. So the computational requirements for doing classification are very simple. The kernel functions don't really change the computational complexity that much, provided you can compute these kinds of functions quickly. Polynomial kernels were popular initially because they were computationally simple, but you can actually do table lookups and a number of other computational techniques to get to decrease the amount of computation required to approximate these functions. So support vector machines, like a lot of good learning algorithms, the training time is very intensive, but the actual time to do classification is very quick. So you spend all your time essentially working on training. Now, I'm going to come back to the examples at the end of class. I thought I'd go through the rest of the lecture first, and then we can look at both algorithms together. Now, what are some of the limitations of these support vector machines? And when these were first introduced, these limitations were severe because it was very unclear how to apply these problems to multi-class problems or to apply them to applications like speech recognition or image recognition or things like that. But for simple binary classification tasks, you could show a lot of nice results with support vector machines. So one of the limitations of the support vector machine is that the theory that we just described is based on a binary decision rule. And in general, we have multiple classes to worry about, so it's not clear how to extend this approach to multiple classes. So very often, what people will do is they will use what's called the one versus many approach. They will train for each one of your classes, they will train a classifier where you have the class of interest as one class and all the other data as the other class. So if you have n classifiers, you're going to have to build n support vector machine models. And then you're going to have to test your incoming data against all n of those models and then perhaps choose the model which fits the data best. So that's one way that you can extend these to multiple classes is this one versus many approach. Is that optimal? No, it's a suboptimal approach. But In practice, it can give you some reasonable results. A second problem is that the actual output of the machine is a distance from the hyperplane. And this distance is often not a good measure of our confidence in the classification. So what that means is very often when we deal with probabilities, we also like to have, we can look at some sense of the confidence of that decision. That's often with most probabilistic approaches, you can derive a confidence measure related to your distance, your probability distance measure. But when SVMs were first introduced, what you were getting back was a distance from the hyperplane, not some kind of probability or confidence. So another related detraction is that the support vector machines don't really produce a probability, they produce a distance. Now, what's typically done in that case is that the distances are mapped to probabilities using a sigmoid function. A sigmoid function has this nice property sigmoid functions look like this, right? And the nice property about these sigmoid functions are that you can take any variable which has some range and essentially map it to the scale 1 minus 1. So what's been done for many years in neural networks and with support vector machines is that the output of the support vector machine, the distance, is mapped to a probability using a sigmoid function. And you can actually train the slope of that sigmoid function on your data and things like that. And that's a common trick that you'll see quite a lot in the literature. Now, another problem is that even with the slack variables, you still have this problem that the number of support vectors will grow linearly with the size of the data set or the complexity of the decision surface. And even with using slack variables and support vector machines, you'll see this behavior on large data sets. In fact, if you're not careful, the number of parameters associated with your model can be much larger than a Gaussian mixture model because it's a discriminative technique, it's not a generative technique, so it's simply enumerating whatever vectors it thinks are needed to describe the surface. There's no attempt to model that surface by some kind of smooth functional form. So this picture is something that we often associate with learning machines. There are a couple points that take important takeaway points from this. So first of all, here we have the training set error as a function of model complexity. One of the important things to notice here is that the error always is, if you have a good learning machine, and people who study these kinds of learning machines have developed theory that describes sort of the optimal learning machines, and neural networks and support vector machines, generally speaking, have this ability to arbitrarily reduce the error to zero with an increase of the number, increasing the number of parameters. Therefore, as graduate students, I want you to, this is one of the main takeaway points for the course. Whenever you're trying to argue that your algorithm is better, one of the things you need to remember is that you have to look at the number of parameters you're using. Because if algorithm A uses more parameters than algorithm B, algorithm A is a more complex model than algorithm B, and therefore algorithm A is expected to do better than algorithm B. It's only when you can achieve the same performance or better performance with same number of parameters or same performance with fewer number of parameters can you really claim that you've made a significant improvement. So model, you always expect on the training set that performance will improve with an increase in the number of parameters or an increase in your model complexity. And that's actually, you can show that using the same kind of derivations that are used to derive support vector machines, empirical risk, and all those kinds of things. Secondly, however, and equally important, is you always expect to be able to get virtually 0% error on the training set. So it's very important that you never evaluate your algorithms on the training data. That's what we call closed-loop testing. And if you do that, you're misleading yourself, because it's always expected that with a good learning machine, you can get arbitrarily good error rates on the training data. Now, you're thinking, well, I would never cheat like that. But I bet many of you have been in the lab at night, late at night, running some experiment, and you have what you call an evaluation set. And you run this experiment and you get 3.1% error on the evaluation set. And then you change a parameter and you get 2.9% error, which is good. And, you know, you run home and say, look, I got this improvement. But think about that. In the process of doing that, you've now made your evaluation set your training set. Because you're using knowledge about the evaluation set to adjust the parameters of your model. So in serious research in these areas, and we've spent a lot of time on this in the speech research community, and I think history shows we've been one of the communities that have really led this whole field. We're only allowed to process the evaluation data set once. And every year when we do these industry-wide evaluations, we get a different evaluation set. Because the minute that we have a saying that once you've run an evaluation set, it's no longer an evaluation set. Once you get some estimate of performance on that set, any decision you make to improve performance is informed by that knowledge. So in many application scenarios now, the evaluation data is what's called withheld, or it's secret. And sometimes you'll provide your algorithm and you'll get back your performance numbers from a independent testing organization, but you won't really know what the correct answers were for the evaluation data that you were given. You're just told what your performance is. In earlier days, we used to actually do this with hardware. You would have to go into a room, set up your hardware. All the different vendors would set up their hardware, and then they'd have to leave the room. And then the independent testing organization would actually run the data through the hardware and evaluate the systems and then publish the performance of the system. And I can't tell you the number of times people's hardware had glitches, like the hardware wouldn't turn on or something, and they got, you know, 0% accuracy, 100% error because of that. You weren't allowed to run back in the room and fix your hardware or something. That would be sort of cheating. But the important thing here is that for a good learning machine, we expect the error rate to go to zero on data that we know about, which we call training data. However, we also know that because of generalization and overfitting and some of these concepts, as model complexity increases, we would expect the performance on the test, on the evaluation set, the blind evaluation set, or what we call the open loop error, we would expect that to continue to increase. But at some point, we're going to see the error rate on the test data increase while the error rate on the training data continues to decrease. Why? You will see this for almost any problem space you work in. And why is that the case? Overfitting, right? That at some point, the learning algorithm is now simply learning the unique aspects of that training set and not learning important discrimination properties, right? It's just modeling the training set better and better. And therefore, this point where you get this minimum, this is sort of your optimum operating point. So typically when we're developing algorithms, we will verify that this is the case, but then we will try to use some held out data to determine what the optimum operating point is. Typically what we'll do is we'll take the training data set and we'll partition off a what we call development test set, which is a subset of the training set that we use to simulate these kinds of open loop experiments. And that's required if you want to do things like estimate this slack parameter C, which controls how much slack you're going to have in your support vector machine model. So this kind of a characteristic is true for almost any really good learning machine that's capable of giving you high performance. And therefore, it's very important to not allow the model to overtrain during training. Another thing we'll talk about later in the semester that you can do is you can partition your data sets into multiple sets, and you can look at performance across those multiple subsets to get some idea of what the right parameter settings for your learning machine are. But we recognize that with a technique like support vector machines, we have a fundamental problem that the machine will overfit if we don't let it. It has a tendency to overfit the data, and we have to have some way of dealing with that. Also, we are very likely to end up with a very large number of support vectors for a data set, and again, that's not good because that probably means we're going to overfit. So people began looking at ways to merge Bayesian techniques with support vector machine type techniques. And this led to something that is called a relevance vector machine. That's one example of a merging of these theories. But in general, people began thinking seriously about ways you can merge Bayesian concepts with support vector machines, because the support vector machines, as introduced, are really not Bayesian in any sense. And the way this is done is through a concept called evidence maximization. So a fully specified probabilistic model, as we've discussed through the semester, incorporates prior information, what people sometimes call beliefs, as well as a notion of confidence in prediction. David McKay, who's a very well-known Bayesian statistician and has been one of the people behind Bayesian statistical methods, posed a special form for regularization in neural networks, which he called sparsity. And the idea here was, could you include in your specification a knob that you could turn that essentially allows you to trade confidence for the number of parameters? So if you wanted to be really confident about your solution, you would get a large number of parameters. If you were willing to tolerate less confidence about your solution, you would get fewer numbers of parameters. He wanted the machine to be able to only learn at the level of complexity needed to classify the data and to not overfit. And this is done through a concept called evidence maximization. So what's done is to evaluate candidate models based on their evidence and to try to essentially choose the model based on its relevance. Now, if you read the paper on coin tosses, you'll actually see some of this language in that paper, because that's essentially one of the ideas behind the coin toss experiment. The Euro coin we talked about earlier in the semester. There's many different models you could postulate for that data. In fact, I don't want to say anything about the exam, but you know, after the distance students have a chance to take the exam, we can talk a little bit about the exam problems. But there's many different models you could postulate, and what David McKay is trying to argue is we can pose the choice of the best model in terms of this evidence maximization process. So the evidence approximation is we're going to approximate the probability of the data given the model as a product of the probability of the data given the weights and the model times the probability of the weights themselves given the model. In other words, we're going to assign some, it's a Bayesian type approach where we're going to ask the question, we should also weight the parameters by the likelihood of those parameters so that hopefully we can choose the parameters of the model that are the most likely parameters, because not all parameter sets are equally likely. So the likelihood of the data given the best fit parameter set can be written as the probability of the data given W hat, which are the parameters, and H, given the model. And the penalty that measures how well our posterior model fits our prior assumptions can be written as the probability of W hat given H times delta W. And what we then should be able to do in this kind of a formulation is to set the priors in the favor of sparse, smooth models. And what the way this is done in practice is using essentially what's called an automatic relevance determination model over each weight. And that model is essentially a Gaussian model where we weight the parameter by a zero mean Gaussian distribution with a variance which is proportional to this alpha. So, I'm going through this, I don't expect you to understand much about this, I'm just trying to give you a flavor for what's the basic idea here. In a nutshell, what this does, and this is a technique that can be applied to most any learning machine, is in addition to postulating a model with parameters, another model is added which essentially models the probability of that parameter in terms of a weight or a confidence. And this allows you to find the parameter, assuming this Gaussian distribution is a good model. This allows you to select the parameters which have the most relevance to the problem, the ones which essentially explain more of the data. So if you think about this in a support vector machine context, this is going to allow you to look at each support vector and have some estimate of how important that support vector is to the overall solution. It'll pick a subset of the support vectors that are most critical to the ultimate decision surface. So it gives you a parameter you can turn to control how many support vectors you're going to get out of the process. And you'll see in the signal processing literature, in the research literature, you'll see talk about evidence maximization and automatic relevance determination with most algorithms now, because this approach can be extended to almost any algorithm, because you're essentially just adding another, it's a Bayesian type approach where you're adding another probability which relates to your confidence in the parameters themselves. So one particular implementation of this, which was created a lot of excitement about 6-7 years ago, was known as relevance vector machines. And we actually have an implementation of these in the Java applet, so you can look at, we probably won't have time today, but you can look offline and you can compare support vector machine solution to relevance vector machine solution on the same data in the applet. And what you'll see is that the relevance vector machine solution always gives you fewer parameters. So what relevance vector machines, what they're all about is essentially, it's still a kernel-based learning machine, much like support vectors, only now each support vector is going to be weighted by this automatic relevance determination prior over each weight. So we're going to postulate a probability distribution for each weight, and we're going to try to find the subset of the weights that essentially are most relevant. So the goal in training then becomes maximization of the probability of the weights with respect to this relevance parameter. And And what should result from this process is that many of the weights that are not really important to the process should have alphas which are very small associated with them. So as you go through this optimization, and there is a closed form solution to this maximization under some conditions, but typically we have to iteratively reestimate the W's and the alphas. And the details of this are described in some of the references on the title page. But it's a pretty involved optimization process. But the result of that optimization process is essentially you have a weight associated with each parameter of your model that tells you how important that parameter is to the overall model. And then what you can simply do is truncate the weight, set some value for alpha, and throw away the weights below that value. And one of the reasons that works nicely is because your overall classification machine is just the sum of all these weights. So all this is really doing is helping you order your support vectors into the ones that are most influential on the overall solution. This approach allows you to reduce the complexity of a support vector machine by at least an order of magnitude and get about the same level of performance. So you can also think of it as a process that takes a support vector machine and then sort of refines it to give you a less complex machine that gives you the same level of performance. And that's something that we're always interested in. So let's see if we can quick, I think we've got a couple minutes. Let's see if we can actually run a quick example. I think what I'll do is just draw. Let me so we make this run fast, I'll just draw some data. Okay, so here we have two classes. We'll need a nonlinear surface to separate these. So let's first try our support vector machines. And what it's done is it's drawn the support vectors that contribute to the decision surface. And now it's actually computing the decision surface. The decision surface takes a little longer to compute in Java because it's now composed of all these support vectors. So you have to sort of search the algorithm that is used to find the decision surface is a little bit expensive. But lo and behold, we get 0% error. Support vector machines can be pretty powerful if the data is well separated. And you'll notice that the algorithm actually learned, when I drew this, I was a little bit sloppy here, And it actually was able to build a surface which was pretty accurate. So now if we, I think it says here somewhere the total number of support vectors. Well, it doesn't, but let's now go with, we can select relevant vector machines. And the idea here is that we should get the same performance with fewer fewer support vectors. Or we might get slightly worse performance, but hopefully a more general machine. The relevance vector machine training process is about an order of magnitude more complex than the support vector machine training process. I think it's doing some kind of optimization. So anyway, I'll stop here, but you can play with this at home. Just try to keep the data sets small because the computations are fairly slow in Java. And the relevant vector machines take quite a while to run. But what it will typically do is produce a solution that gives you about the same performance as a support vector machine, but with fewer parameters. Okay, can we stop recording?